Welcome to Attachment Theory in Action, a bi-weekly podcast presented by the Knowledge Center at Chadok. Join our host, Jenna Kelly, as she dives into the world of attachment theory and trauma with field experts from across the nation.
Hello there, my Attachment Theory in Action podcast listeners and viewers. I'm your host, Jenna Kelly, and I hope this interview finds you well and feeling secure wherever you are listening or watching today. I am really honored to share this next conversation with you. I think it's going to give you the warm and fuzzies because anytime you're in the presence of Dr. Linda Gilkerson, she has the gift to do that because she not only walks the walk, but really talks the talk and how she shows up. She has been such a huge contributor to the field of infant mental health, reflective supervision, attachment, and she is the developer of a tool called FAN. And that's what we're going to talk a lot about in this interview. FAN stands for Facilitated Attuned Interaction. And what's really awesome about the FAN is that it's got really broad applications. It's more of a framework, so it's not a therapy. It's a way of being. It's a way of how you're interacting and attuning to the other person. So it has everything to do with attachment. And it's, like I said, you can apply it to various different settings because it's really universal. So let me just give you more of the formal introduction of Dr. Gilkerson. She is a PhD in LSW, a professor at Erickson Institute, where she directs the graduate training programs in infancy and infant mental health. She founded Erickson's first clinical initiative, Fussy Baby Network, which is a national model for home visiting program for parents of infants under 1 year. And then, like I said, she's the developer of the FAN, which is used in home visitation, early intervention, early childhood mental health consultation, physician training. And her research and publications have focused on relationship-based approaches and reflective supervision in a range of settings. She's been a longtime board member of 0-3. She's led or served on many early childhood task forces in Illinois and was recently awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Bright Promises Foundation for her work on behalf of young children. I can't think of anyone more fitting for this. And I encourage our listeners to check out our YouTube channel as well. And please give a like, a subscribe, all of that to both on our podcasts, wherever you listen to this podcast, and also our YouTube channel. That's always appreciated and helps get these interviews out into the heads and hearts of people who need them. But also because Dr. Gilkerson is going to share some visuals of the FAN that will go with what we're talking about. So it will be a really helpful reference, especially if you're more of a visual learner. So sit back and enjoy this interview with Dr. Gilkerson.
The Knowledge Center at Chadok is a tremendous resource for therapists, educators, business and organizational leaders, and anyone curious about trauma-informed care. At tkcchadok.org, you'll find information about registering for our professional development courses like the Developmental Trauma and Attachment Institute, Adult Attachment Interview Workshops, or the Nonprofit Leadership Academy. You'll also find a library of Chadok publications in the TKC store, including the entire Michael Trout book and video collection. Visit tkcchadok.org for videos, articles, workshops, and podcasts in the arena of attachment and trauma-informed care.
Well, hello, Linda. Welcome. It is such a true honor to be joining you in conversation today on the podcast.
Pleasure to be here with you, Jenna.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. I knew that you were somebody that I had to have on here at some point because your contributions to the field of infant mental health and attachment have been so profound, and you're really a legend. I know you're going to resist
years
that.
Years in the field, it all adds up.
And I know you're humble, so I figured you'd resist that, but it's true. I think you need to own it. And I know you've had so many amazing teachers along the way, so I want to talk about that too. And today we're going to also be talking a lot about your work with FAN, which stands for Facilitated Attuned Interactions, mm-hmm. and how that relates to attachment. Before we do, I really want to invite more of you into our conversation. And so the question that I always start with is, could you please share an attachment memory that feels really important to you and to your work?
Yes. You know, I have to go back to the very beginning, Jen. I always say I got into the field of infancy on the day I was born. I was born on the day I was supposed to be born. weighing about 4.5 pounds. So I was fine, but it was very scary for my parents. And in those days, parents couldn't visit their baby. They couldn't really be there for quite a while. And so I was in the hospital, they were at home. And so I think we had a rough beginning. That sense of connection was one that had to be achieved. And I think that's true in a lot of attachment relationships. It's not automatic, right? You have to build it over time. So I also, my parents were both in the military, so they were very, you know, organized, very structured people. And my brother fit right into that. And my presentation was very different, you know, as a fussy baby. We talk about relationships being achieved, not assumed. And I think together with my parents, we achieved that fit, but it wasn't easy in the beginning. And we talk about, you know, who are you to the parent and who, and so they received a baby that was very different than they expected. And I think that's partly why I've committed myself to this whole area of infant mental health and developing a program for fussy babies. I then had a fussy baby myself and experienced the same challenge of loving that baby, you know, who was, you know, he was, I always said to my him, he was just fine. It was me that was struggling, you know, with the fit. So, attachment relationships take time.
Yeah. You taught your parents so much. Maybe lessons they didn't want to learn, but you were there to teach them. Yeah. And, you know, we always say it's no accident when we end up in the fields that we're in, because so much of that does come back to our roots and our attachment memories. And so that was a beautiful example of that. Mm-hmm. So I know we're going to talk about FAM, but there's so much to your stories and who you are, Linda. And that was just a little sample. And you've had so many important mentors along the way. I'm just in awe. So I'd love for you to just share more about your professional journey and some of the mentors you've had along the way.
Well, you know, my original training was in special education. And one of the founders of special education, Cruikshank, said, you can lead from inspiration or you can lead from information. Mm-hmm. And I think that really stuck with me because I think my field has been shaped by both. Inspiration through my own experience and then hopefully acquiring information, you know, around that. And I was in preschool special ed for quite a long time. And then I saw this picture on the book by Klaus and Kennel of maternal infant bonding. And I said, that's what I have to do. I have to do babies. I didn't know why I had to do babies yet. That was my own personal journey back to my own birth and my own experience. But I reached out to Barry Brazelton, who was the preeminent America's pediatrician, done the original research on infancy, and said, is it possible that I could come and work with you? And like every good pediatrician, he returned all those pink slip phone calls and he called me back and made it possible for me to come to the child development unit there in Boston, where it really started my career in infancy. And Barry always said, the baby will lead you. You know, if you and the families can focus on the baby, you know, you will know how to partner with each other. And that was a powerful message to me. And the other thing he taught us, and we use this in all our work, is that all parents have two vulnerabilities. It's a program running in the background. No matter how old your child is, you know, is my baby okay? You know, is my preschooler okay? She's not talking yet and other kids are. Is my 7-year-old okay? Doesn't have a best friend yet. What about my high schooler? Will they make it? You know? So always a worry about their baby. And then the parallel worry, am I doing enough? Mm. You know, and then I think we as professionals ask ourselves, carry our own vulnerabilities. Are they okay? And how will I know? And how can I help? So I think holding that brings humility to the work, as well as a real recognition of the inherent vulnerability of parenting. And through Barry, I had a chance to meet Heidi Alls, who really redesigned the whole field of developmental care and neonatal intensive care units. And her mantra, which I learned so much from, was the baby is an ally in their care. Again, if you can organize around what the baby needs, you know, you'll be able to meet those needs and the baby's development will thrive. And she'd say, what is that baby's developmental agenda right now? And I think if we can bring that lens again to each of our interactions and partner around that, it can be a real guide to us. So a couple of very important mentors I've been so lucky to have.
It gave me goosebumps just hearing you talk about them. And it's no wonder you are who you are and you approach the work the way that you do, Linda. So that makes me wonder more. I mean, some of that feels so intuitive already, but how your work continued to evolve, what you continued to learn through Fussy Babies, and then how that developed into your work of the fan.
Well, another mentor was Irving Harris, who's a philanthropist here, was in Chicago. And he believed long before many people did that mothers and families needed support very, very early. He really supported doulas, which is like a big idea even now. And years ago, he was advocating for doulas. So he was a supporter of Erickson and supporter of our work and gave me the opportunity to develop a program, you know, through his funding support. And so with other colleagues, we decided to focus on Fussy Babies and their parents. And Barbara Bowman, who was president of Erickson then, said, you got to get some data. Every baby cries, you know, nobody's going to fund that program. For wonderful honesty. And so my colleague, Larry Gray, pediatrician who I partnered with for many years, and I went and we looked at all the admissions for infant crying to the emergency room at the University of Chicago for a year. And interestingly, what we found was that a minority of those really had came out with medical diagnoses. That parents were there because they were worried. They were stressed. The baby was crying. They didn't know why. And that they were at the end of their rope. They were coming for support. So that was important validation, you know, that this is an issue that is really significant for families. And we know from the research that infant crying is a trigger for abusive head trauma. So a rare occurrence, but absolutely happens. And anything that we can do to prevent that, we want to do. So the data we had combined with that risk factor and interviews with parents, interestingly, even though I had my own lived experience, we sat down with parents and said, what has been like for you, you know, caring for your baby? And we learned four big things from them. One was that they were emotionally and physically exhausted. This is 24/7. They also, in that exhaustion, had pulled away from their support systems. You would think that you would reach out more. But what happened with that fussy baby is the people who loved them and wanted to help them often were advice giving. You know, we're kind of telling them what they needed to do, and they internalize it as I'm doing everything wrong, you know. And so that we learned to ask parents, you know, what is supportive to you and not assume that we knew. So we also learned that they were continually looking for the cause of this crying and a cure, what will help it end. And then in that pursuit, they had lost confidence in themselves and lost confidence in their baby. So we knew that whatever program we developed, it was about building that parenting muscle. You know, we really believe, Bechtel Papaschek was another mentor. She and her husband did the original research on looking at micro analytic studies of parent-child interactions. And what they saw is that most of parenting is non-conscious. You don't even know you're doing it. And you're making all of these intuitive adjustments to your baby to help that baby settle and regulate so the baby can feel secure, can feel held, and feel known. That's the attachment relationship beginning. And so we believe that that capacity was there, even though it wasn't able to be shown in the beginning. You know, so we had an approach that watched for what parents were already doing, even in the smallest ways. And we would try to highlight that for them to rebuild some of that confidence that was there.
Yeah. And what have you learned from some of those families with fussy babies?
Wow. You know, we learned that we needed to hold ourselves to be present to them, that their stories were hard to hear at times, And we also wanted to rush in and fix, you know, and so we knew that we needed a framework to guide us. And that's really where the fan came from. Winnicott says you need to be grounded in order to adapt to need. And so we knew we needed to be grounded in a framework so that we could adapt to need rather than react to need. And that's where the fan, you know, really came from, a grounding tool for us so we could be present and truly hear their experience.
Yeah. And it sounds like really be that secure base and safe haven for families, that parallel of them being able to form an attachment with those helping professionals and right. to feel held and seen so that they can do that with their baby that is, you know, this, mm-hmm. like you said, it may not have met that expectation of I'm just supposed to know what to do. And now I've got this fussy baby and it feels messy. And mm-hmm. that makes me lose confidence in myself. As a yeah. parent, like, you know, back to those two questions, those brilliant questions of mm-hmm. Dr. Brazelton, is my baby okay? And am I good enough?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And one of the things about security of attachment is that when you feel that security, what you feel on the inside, you can show on the outside.
Yeah.
Because you've learned to trust and that you've been trusted. And so I think our fan approach tries to create that safe space so that people can tell us, we say their reality, their felt reality, and that we can hear it, we can hold it for them, we can acknowledge it, and over we can explore it, and over time we can help them begin to integrate new experiences. That's one way that healing occurs. And to be able to go forward with more confidence.
So do you want to get into more about defining the fan for us?
Sure. So what did we learn? We learned that we really had to hear. We really had to do deep listening, if you will. And so our theory of change really became that of attunement. That if someone feels connected to you and understood by you, then they're open to the relationship, they're open to learning, and they're open to change. So how can you, you know, I'm trained as a social worker. We always talk about starting where the client is, and many people have that same framework. But how in the world do you do that? You know, how can you really meet somebody where they are? And that's that essence of connection, meeting someone where they are, not having to fix them or change them in that moment, but a little bit of radical acceptance. I get it. I hear you. And so that became our framework. I can pull up a slide here.
Sure. And yeah. our listeners can also check out our YouTube channel so that they can see this yeah. visual of the fan.
Awesome. Let me just pull up my screen here. And I'll go back a couple of slides. And often I tell the story about our first families. You know, how do you meet someone where they are? And they were in very different places. Our first family was a family physician who was calling for sleep tips. And we know how many times that family physician had given sleep tips out, but he was calling for another reason, which he wasn't quite able to articulate yet. So he needed that deep listening, that presence that made it safe for what was on the inside to be shared on the outside. And with that, he was able to say, I don't love my baby. And I never thought I would ever say that. He had a fragile baby, hard for him to soothe, even though he was very skilled with babies. And so he was able to really, I think, feel relief, speaking the unspeakable, as Alicia Lieberman would say, and having that heard and accepted. It wasn't a long call. That was really, I think, that was really what he needed. And so you think, okay, we've got this figured out. Emotional support is where families are. Brother, family member, younger parent, new baby was looking for something else. And this is where you have to read the cues and meet people where they are. She'd been taking her baby to emergency room to emergency room, saying there's something wrong here. There's something wrong here. She needed us to be very serious with her, to take her, to really respect what she was saying, to point to what she was looking at. Is that what you're worried about? Yes, I see it too. Can you tell me what you think is happening? And then really validate that and then say, would it be okay if I shared my thoughts about what it might be? And sharing that and then talking together about this and then offering, would it be okay if we follow this together? So a different kind of partnership.
Was
needed.
And I think that's the attunement that you're talking about, that FAN offers a framework for this.
Yeah. And it offers, this is where I was mentioning about how parents had taught us, they taught us that we have to stay much longer in the hard places. You know, I had a parent tell me that her baby was evil, hard to hear. Tell me more about that. What is it that you're experiencing that makes you feel your baby's evil? And letting that story unfold. You have to see through the parent's eyes first. We say we have to put away, we have to kind of put what we know in a suitcase and park it for a moment, you know, where you're really getting to understand what they know. I had a mom of a very young baby call and say her baby had autism. So I'm sure I was like the fifth or sixth person she'd tried to talk to about that. You know, and really inviting their story. What is it you're seeing that makes you feel your baby might have autism? Let's talk about it together. Only then, I think, can parents really feel heard and seen. And you're not agreeing, but you're saying, I hear you. I understand this is exactly what you're experiencing. And right. let's sort that out together.
Right? Meeting that mom where she is mm-hmm. versus, I'm sure, where that advice giving support system that you talked about that sometimes parents will turn away from because so many others would probably just dismiss that and say, yeah. Oh, your baby's fine, you know, and to really hear her.
Yeah, exactly.
Power of that. And yeah.
The power, and often people will move on then, you know, it's so important, you know, to be heard and to have your experience shared that you can't let go of that until until that's happened. When it happens, that's that idea of attunement. Then you're open, you know, to exploring things in a different way. And we also learned that parents have to find their own way. I love this quote from Eric Erickson. He says, parents with somatic conviction. They got to believe in their body. This is the right thing to do. They can't do it on a consistent basis. You know, so that's how we developed all our collaborative exploration questions and skills. What do you think's going on here? You know, what have you seen? And parents might say, I don't know, but usually there's a but. I don't know, but, and then you can draw that out. Because again, we believe in that intuitive knowing that parents are picking up on all kinds of small things that, and that you can build. It's not that they're experts. I've never felt like an expert as a parent. I still don't at all, but they have experiences. They have a ton of experience, you know, that you can draw on to build on. And then, as I mentioned, we needed that model to hold us as well as to hold the parent. And that's our theory of change. When someone feels truly understood and known, that's where the space is, where you can try something new. And this comes right from Ed Tronick's work. You know, what percentage of the time are we going to get it just right in an attunement? It's a dynamic process of attunement, and mismatch is the norm. And so this is reassuring to us when we train in the FAN, you know, that relationships are achieved, as I mentioned, not assumed. You got to work at it, you know, and you may have to adapt and go slower or go faster, you know. The repair is the strength. And I think as professionals, we haven't really realized that that's a professional competency as well. To be able to go back and say, you know, I think I really missed the boat last time I was here. I was so excited about, we had one home visitor who was so excited. This young father wanted to go to learn to drive. You know, he kind of overwhelmed him with his enthusiasm. And then the dad stopped showing up for the visits. And so there's this rupture, this mismatch. But the opportunity for repair came when he did see the dad again in the community. And he went up to him and said, I'm just wondering if something happened on our last visit. You know, did I say something or do something, you know, that made you uncomfortable? I really would like to reconnect again. And then the story of the driving came up and the dad said, I'm really afraid to drive, basically. It's not something he was ready to run down and do. So the mismatch can be repaired and the relationships can be strengthened. And that's a very reassuring message. We call it, when those mismatches happen, we call it a 70-30. It was a 70-30. You know, to normalize it and to think about, you know, what possibilities are here for repair. And Ed Tronick reminds us that repair is an accomplishment of the relationship. It's not something you can do. The home visitor couldn't make that happen. He could offer it, but it was the father then who was able to share, yeah, this happened. And then together they were able to go forward. So it's a relational concept, repair.
Yeah, so much wisdom in that. And I think it's such a reassurance, like you said, that the goal is not 100%. That's not obtainable.
Right.
And so when we see the 70-30, it reminds us that good enough parenting and the power of repair is where that relationship and those attachments are then strengthened.
Exactly. That's what makes the relationship sturdy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, actually, Winnicott said a long time ago that babies only need near perfect attunement for a very short period of time, you know, just in that very beginning. And then they need that good enough mother to kind of dose the, if we might say, to dose the sensitivity as well, you know, not have to respond automatically. So the baby then, if you don't go past the baby's threshold, the baby can develop a little ego strength in this. Hey, wait a minute. I can wait a little bit. Mom will be there. I know. You know, this is all learned, you know, over time. And so that's the strength in attachment relationships.
But it's so important in those early moments of attunement and trying to understand what that is as a parent and as a helping professional so that we can build that resilience up over time. And especially when, you know, those examples of fussy babies and I'm feeling like I may not love my baby and what does this mean? And so how we can be with those parents and caregivers in those moments so that they can get back to attuning.
Right. Exactly. We say that parenting is not knowing what to do, but parenting is figuring out what to do. And I think that's very reassuring too.
Mm.
Yeah. It's interesting, research on infant crying, the research always evolves and it may change, but at this point, we don't think that specific cries necessarily have specific meanings. And what happens is the parent goes to work and they put the picture together. You know, they hear that cry and they think, when did I feed him last? Oh, he looks a little hot. Maybe I'll adjust him. They do the work of parenting. And so that cry's a signal, you know, but it doesn't tell them exactly what to do. That's the creative hard work of parenting.
Yeah, the making meaning of what does this mean?
Exactly. Right. And that takes time. And the more experience you have with it, the better. So if one caregiver has more experience, you know, doing that kind of meaning making, then they're going to look like they've got a lot more skills and people often defer to that parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the beginning, not most of the time, nobody knows exactly what to do. It's all figuring it out.
Yes, thank you for naming that. None of us know what we're doing. We're figuring it out.
Right.
Well, let's keep going with the fan and
sure.
Get more into how the important framework that it offers us.
Happy to. Let me pull up again. So I'll actually show you the fan here. So we have different versions of the fan, which is interesting. At this point, we're working, the fan is applied in all kinds of settings in addition to our work with fussy babies. But this was our kind of original fan. And in the middle is that person that you're focusing on. Here it could be a parent, a caregiver. Again, we just got a grant to work with the Academy of Pediatrics to bring the fan much more widely into primary care pediatrics, into residency training, partnering with Healthy Steps to bring the fan into Healthy Steps as well. So lots of people are looking for a grounding framework, you know, to help them with this attunement process. So you've got the person that you're focusing on in the center. And then around it, you've got these wedges, we call, of the fan. And the first wedge, the calming wedge, is our wedge, because the fan is a model of attunement to yourself and attunement to others. And this is where you're tracking your own experience. We call it a compassionate internal pause. You know, in an interaction, all of a sudden I realize, ooh, that dad, you know, just scared me. Or, oh, I'm really worried about that mom. She seems so anxious today, you know, or I'm so exhausted, you know, I can't wait to get out, get done and have something to eat. You know, it's this in your internal world and being able to catch yourself, to notice when you've been pulled away and to be able to pause ideally and give it a name if you can, because it's not just distraction. It could be important information, you know, that you're picking up on. So you want to try and name it for yourself. You want to try and use strategies. We call this our mindful self-regulation strategies. Breathing, grounding, self-talk, and imagery are the most common ones that people use. So in that moment, you can rebalance, recenter yourself with that compassionate internal pause. And then think, what is going to be the most effective use of me at this point? And this is where you can read the other, use the other wedges to think where the other person is. Are they in feelings as the father was that I mentioned to you? They were subtle in the beginning, but, and then you can be there. We call it listening with acceptance in the feeling wedge. That's your primary job. You're conveying, let the story be told. I can hear it exactly as you're experiencing it. And we talk about holding feelings, which is primarily nonverbal, just conveying a listening stance and a caring stance and an open stance. You can validate, you can explore, you can bridge from feelings. Did you have a thought, Jenna?
Well, speaking of being attuned, thank you, Linda. I was just thinking about the power of mindful self-regulation. Why that's so needed to be able to be in any of these other wedges. And as you were talking about feeling, it's like, yes, no wonder we need to be regulated in our own systems and have to attune to ourselves first to really be in the feeling. And especially with that dad who was able to share so vulnerably, I suspect that he may not have opened up in that way had if he was with you or whoever he was with and that helping professional, if they hadn't done that MS, you know, the acronym MSR first.
Right.
And the other, oh, go ahead, Linda.
No, please.
Well, and the other thing that I love about the MSR, mindful self-regulation, is the M, which is that it reminds us that it's intentional.
Yeah.
And I think there's so many times where as helping professionals, I am in my own experience where I might be doing something in the moment, but I'm not aware that I'm really doing this as a way to self-regulate. Like maybe I go straight to the doing wedge as a way to regulate myself because I'm not able to stay in the feeling or it's too uncomfortable. Or I back to that question of, am I enough as a helping professional right now? And so if I don't go to doing, I might not have done enough. I love this framework and I know we're just getting started on the two wedges already and it just brings up so much reflection for me.
Yes. And you know this model. Jen is a fan trainer too, and she's used it for many years and has helped other people with the framework.
Yeah, it's so important. It's such, like you said, a grounding tool.
Yeah, right. And when we think about grounding, it helps us know where we are, right? So we can be present for the other. Okay. And I think that mindful self-regulation, you might go back to often in a visit. You might drop back there quite a few times, right? Or it might be a visit that flows and it doesn't take a lot. But it's always available, you know, for you. And it's also not like a switch that you just switch on. Okay, mindful self-regulation, I'm cool now. You know, it may take some work in that moment. Yeah.
And I wonder if it's also, it's a tool, but we can also be aware of maybe I'm not able to use MSR right now and be as present and attuned as I need to be. So what mm-hmm. do I need to do if I can't get back on the wedge, if I can't be that mm-hmm. secure base?
Yeah, right. And that can happen. Remember 70-30. Mm-hmm. And as we think about, those are times for hopefully for reflective supervision that you do have a space, you know, where you can take Absolutely. That to and think, you know, I just had such a hard visit. You know, can I talk about this with you? And again, all the wonderful reflective skills that people have are essential. And a couple of fan questions are, you know, what was it like for you to be with this person? Where do you think they were in the fan? Where do you think you were? Just those simple questions, people often have an insight.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're building more about social identities in, you know, who is this person to you? And who do you think they might have seen you as? And any relationships about power that might have influenced the interaction. Anything's related to race, age, gender, you know, past history. So opening the space in a safe way to really unpack what might have been happening. And then, you know, looking at it again, we think about repair as strengthening relationships. If you, you know, if you, when, next time you see them, is there anything you can take forward with you from this that will help you next time you see them? So all I think a good reflective process.
Mm.
Yeah. And the other thing we've added in is self-compassion, because there are those mismatches. And then what's another way you can hold yourself, you know, when you feel you have missed the boat, when you've let somebody down, and how can you hold yourself gently and kindly in those moments and kind of quiet that harsh critic? And give yourself other messages that are more comforting, that are more soothing, that are more regulating, you know, so then you can go back in a more balanced place.
Yeah, so, it makes me think of repairing with ourselves too, and how we need to do that. And it's sometimes I think easier, at least for me, to think about repairing with others than the way we can be so critical and hard on ourselves at times. So I love that you've added that self-compassion in. And again, it starts with us and our ability to do that so that we can hold others and help them do that.
Right, exactly. It was a missing piece because a fan lets you see things so clearly and you see all the mismatches, but then you know, another layer of how to hold yourself, right? How to repair with yourself first. And sometimes you might not have an opportunity to repair with the other person. The repair may truly be internal.
Mm-hmm.
And self-compassion can help there. Back on the fan, the collaborative exploration wedge is the one that should be bigger for all of us, I think. And in our research on the fan, people will say that the fan helps reduce their stress, maybe even reduces burnout. And we think it's related to collaborative exploration. It's related to mindful self-regulation, but also collaborative exploration, because that's the space of true partnership. That's when you really come at it in that humble inquiry of not knowing, but exploring together. The weight's off your shoulder. You're the guide. You're asking questions. You're building on what people already know. I think it's really the secret sauce, if you will, in many ways, of the fan. It's true partnership. And actually, we train a lot of physicians, and one of our physician colleagues says that the center of the fan should say the parent's true concern. And he really believes that collaborative exploration allows you to get to that space of the parent's true concern. And then you can partner to solve it. And interestingly, our physicians find their visits don't take longer. They're actually more efficient just for that reason.
I'm not surprised by that.
Yeah. And we have this great question, and this may be a Midwestern version of the question, as we'll say, what's your hunch? You know, there may be other ways you would say that. You know, what's your heart tell you? You know, what's your gut say? Starting out to just try and get underneath it, if you will, with parents, because they often will know. You know, if they're struggling, might say, well, which way are you leaning? You know, and they'll often be able to answer that question. Again, you know, drawing out and building on is our whole goal, you know, I think, in partnership. And then there's a doing wedge. You know, people do want access to the expertise of professionals. They want access to what you know. And we say it works best with an invitation. So you're reading those cues and you're seeing when somebody is ready to learn something or ready to try something. And then if you've got the resource, you've got a, you know, perfect match there. And, you know, more and more we're learning about how short attention spans are. I think now for advertising on YouTube and other places, like 8 seconds before someone swipes, you know. So we developed this model of drop and explore, and you've used that, Jenna. Yeah. Try and say something really simply, just one sentence in one breath, and then ask, does that make sense to you? Have you heard that before? Would that apply to your child? And so making information giving a dialogue. What's been your experience with that, Jenna?
Well, so much comes up for me around doing. Like I said, I think especially earlier in my professional development, I felt this need to go straight to doing. And I think I'm comfortable in feelings and have gotten more comfortable in feelings, but I would often feel like I said, that parallel of, am I good enough if I didn't give these strategies and my wisdom and knowledge, and that's why they're here with me. Yeah. And that how many times I probably misattuned. So that's where it comes back to that self-compassion of, we're all just doing our best and figuring this out here. And so when you said the drop and explore and the 8 second, you know, attention span, it's like, yes. And that collaborative exploration being such an important part of the fan. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think over time, I've been able to just trust the process more and trust the fan as that grounding tool rather than, you know, just give, you know, give in the doing. And sometimes if I've spent a lot of time in feelings, then I would do like this machine gun style at the end, but I still have to give you these 5 things to do. And where now, if I trust in the not knowing, and I trust in the child, the parent, the caregiver, the consultee, whoever I'm with, that they're truly an ally, like you said, mm-hmm. and we're doing this together, that so much can come up that I maybe even wasn't even thinking about dropping that nugget because we spent this time in this collaborative exploration process. Mm-hmm. So I think that's just one of the powerful lessons for me with the fan is just trusting the process.
Yeah. Yes. And that takes practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And support as well.
The other thing I love about the fan, and I'm not surprised you've already mentioned its use in pediatrics, its use in, you know, social justice work mm-hmm. and conversations and moving towards racial equity. And there's broad implications and applications. And so mm-hmm. I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about that, expand on the different systems and ways that you're utilizing fan.
Yeah. Well, we started with home visiting. and are able to work in many states. We have over 180 fan trainers now spread across the country, working in different sectors. But home visiting was a place where we really started, and I've partnered with Nurse Family Partnership. We have strong relationships with Healthy Families and other home visiting programs. In our research, what we learned was that the fan does several things in home visiting programs. One, it increases the amount of time spent focusing on parenting, which we are really pleased about. And we think in part that comes from the arc of engagement. You know, we have a way of structuring your engagement with a family. We're in that beginning after that wonderful social connection, saying something like, what's it been like for you to take care of your child since we saw each other last? Or one of our home visitors says, hey, what's mom time been like for you this past week? So some way to pivot to the parenting space early on. We found that the visits are more parent-led, that the agenda comes more from the parent. We found that home visitors are more able to stay present in hard conversations, more able to stay regulated on difficult topics, and that they're more satisfied in their work. And I think that not the what we hear, the game changer is not having to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot of pressure if we have to try to fix it.
Yeah. And so then we're also working in Part C, early intervention. And those are really important relationships. And our research there in Part C says that it shifts therapists from watch me show you how to let's do this together. Again, that partnering. And some of our therapists thought that this would derail their therapy, that they would get less done. But actually the opposite has been true. They were a little cautious about the feeling wedge, you know, but acknowledging, even if it's just brief, like one therapist said to the dad, it's frustrating, isn't it, that nothing's changed so far, you know, that it's still there. Just brief. Yeah. Really frustrating. And then they began to try again. So it can be a lot of your interaction or just small moments. And so again, very powerful in Part C. We've worked in consultation, in which you have been one of the leaders of. Do you want to comment on what you've seen the fan bring to your consultants?
Again, I think it's that ability to have this grounding framework and trust the process of being able to attune to where your consultee is. And, you know, you use the statement of the dad that said, you know, what, I may not love my child. And I just had a consultant who said they heard a teacher say, you know, this child needs an exorcism. Mm-hmm. And how much MSR was needed in that moment to really hold that and then to get back on the fan and let's be in those feelings and then let's explore that a little bit more. So the implications are universal because it's about relationships and attachments.
That's right. It is universal because of that. And we say the fan doesn't teach you new skills. You have these skills. It gives you a way to hold on to them and organize them, you know, so you can read those cues and think, yes, that's what's needed now. It's really a way to use it helps you more intentionally use yourself and all the skills you already have, especially in those tough moments.
Yeah. And I love that you just came out with Group Fan too. So we just spent some time training our early childhood mental health consultants in Group Fan. And so it's a way to be with an individual or a group, which can just be two or more people, which so many times, whether we're with a family or a group, you know, could be doing a group supervision, group reflective supervision, or consulting to a group of teachers, even as trainers. A lot of us work as trainers too, and we're with groups of people. And so how to hold the group on the fan has been a really powerful way to think about it too and expand. So grateful.
You're always an attachment figure, you know, in this work. And that concept of a secure base, you know, a safe haven, secure base for exploration, it's always there. And, you know, we think that the fan can help ground you, you know, so you can be, in a sense, that attachment figure. In that you can be flexible and adapt to need as opposed to react to need.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I love that.
Yeah. And I think Kohut has this idea of the fragmented self versus a vital self. And the fan helps you, I think, be that vital self. It moves you away from the fragmentation because it helps you name things. Oh, that's where they are. It helps you track what's happening so it's not so confusing. Oh, no, not there anymore. They're over here now. And it helps you stay centered in the midst of those dynamics. And that's why I think it's so generalizable.
Yeah, it makes me think of this more holistic presence when you say versus the fragmented self. Mm-hmm. And that attunement, you know, I remember when I first really immersed myself more into the world of attachment and infant mental health, I would hear so much about attunement. And I don't think I really fully understood it because I think I was trying to intellectualize it and just think of it more of like cognitively, what does attunement mean? And I think the fan helps us to do this too, is recognize that it's this holistic way of being present and that it's from that very somatic physiological level of one nervous system to another nervous system. And it's that emotional level of being present. It's that cognitive level. It's, some would say, even spiritual. So it's all of our systems being open and present to receive and adapt, like you said, instead of react.
Right. And it is about mutual growth.
Absolutely.
And the more I work with the fan, the more I understand it. And I also, am challenged by its practice. Yeah.
We learn so much from those that we're with and that we're helping. And the fan is a way to help us make sense of that, reflect on that.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah.
So we touched on some of the other systems, and I love that it's continuing to grow in its application. What else is on the horizon for FAN or any of the research things that you're involved in, Linda? I would love to hear more.
Oh, thank you. Well, as I mentioned, we have a new project with the Academy of Pediatrics to really bring FAN into residency training for practicing pediatricians and to bring a PediaLink, an asynchronous training to practicing pediatricians and partner with Healthy Steps. And I think there's a real early relational health is a true movement in healthcare, and people really want it to be about connection. One of our favorite quotes from front of our fan trained residents was, "I used to go in the room and think diagnosis, and now I go in the room and think connection." And that's what it's all about. And from that connection that can come understanding the true concern, can come using all that expertise that's available in a real partnership. So that's our goal, to come into that room and think connection. So that's one that's on the horizon. We're working with community health workers. That's a new workforce, both in mental health and public health. So we have had a very successful project with that in Ohio and have learned the same things. We're doing a metasynthesis across 16 studies of the FAN in looking across these different areas, including now community health workers, teachers, child welfare as well. So all these systems are looking for ways.
Legal system too, I've heard you talk about, judges.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, we've worked in the court system, and one of the judges has a laminated fan on the bench, and he said, "If I didn't have that, I'd be standing up there yelling right back at him." But it helps me read the room. He was using a group fan, helps me read the room, see where people are, and I understand if someone's upset, they can't hear what I'm saying. You know, so again, attunement, in very, I think, practical and helpful. Helpful ways. We have a colleague that's using the fan with first responders, and so that might be an area that we haven't, done before. So we're just open to growing. Family advocates is another area we've worked in, peer, where there's peer support. and people really needing a guiding framework to help them maintain boundaries and also use their own lived experience as well.
So exciting and so needed. And I've heard you say too that it's not anything new necessarily. It just gives us this language and this shared language to be able to talk about the human experience and those connections that we're trying to make.
Yeah, and it is a shared language. And we talk a lot about the fan as helping us attune to other people, but the fan can also help you help people attune to you. So that's a new use of it. We were just working with a large school who they wanted to focus on teacher-teacher relationships. And so we had them think about each of the wedges of the fan and how could you let your colleague know that you're in feelings? You know, what could you say? You know, I'm just overwhelmed by what I just heard, you know, and I need a minute, they might say. And then what might your response to your colleague be? So we had a really nice set of activities around that. And then the conclusion was people agreeing that that I get permission from my colleagues to let me know what they need. And I will try to respond in an attuned way. So again, the fan can be the language for that.
I remember, especially during the pandemic, what a grounding tool it was. How we were all so dysregulated that it really helped in those colleague relationships where, you know, we would have mismatches and we were holding a group of early childhood mental health consultants. Mm-hmm. And it gave us a chance to come back and repair and say, you know what, I think you were all in feelings. And we felt like we need to go straight to doing because this is this mm-hmm. new crazy thing that none of us have ever experienced. Right. And so we wanted to help figure out like what to do. And mm-hmm. we missed that so many of you were in feelings. And so now we continue to use it as a way to check in with our team of where are we at so that we are attuned to what those needs are.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think that models so much for people that they can then say to themselves, hey, it's okay if I acknowledge my, you know, my mismatch to other people. And I think that increases the safety in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, secure relationships can do hard things together because they don't disconnect, you know, they don't, there's no need to attack or there's no need to collapse, if you will. You can stay connected through hard things. And I think that the fan can help people stay connected through hard things.
Absolutely.
Partially, just like you're saying, by naming it. Mm-hmm. Well, here we are and none of us know what to do. You know.
Yeah.
And we are here together. Yeah.
So anything else you want to tell us about that? And we'll link all of these things where people can learn more about fan in the show notes. But I know you also are doing a lot of cool things at Erickson Institute.
Yes, really love to tell you about that. We're starting a new master's program, which embeds infant mental health and early intervention together. So it's a master's in early childhood on infant mental health informed early intervention.
Oh, wow. So needed.
Yes. So it'll give all those great skills that you need to be an early intervention developmental therapist, or to add that relational component to your work, as you might already be an OT in early intervention, et cetera. So that's going to be a really great new master's program, and that'll start in spring of 2020.
And will that be remote too, or do people need to? Okay.
No, absolutely. And so we can maybe put information in the, give you a link.
We'll link that too. Yes. That's so exciting.
Yeah. And we also have we are one of the only social work programs that has a concentration in infant and early childhood mental health. So you can learn relational assessment, parent-child relational assessment, birth to five, and infant mental health interventions within an MSW program. And that's also online, so anyone can take advantage of that program. And then we have our wonderful certificate program in infant mental health, which is for people with a bachelor's degree or master's with some experience in having a certificate in infant and early childhood mental health. And that's crosswalked with the Alliance for the Advancement of Infant Mental Health. So if you're in states that have the endorsement, then that can count toward it. And we're hoping our new master's program will as well. So very exciting things.
Yeah, you're changing the world by the way you are growing these professionals and with the contribution of FAN. So what to end us, because gosh, this hour has just flown by, what do you envision on how FAN can continue to help relationships and attachments in the world? And it is in the world. I mean, it's not just in the U.S. You're using this in internationally. So what do you envision?
You know, I think part of it is staying humble ourselves, you know, and just keeping learning from the people that are using the FAN, and staying open. Our theme is it's about mutual growth. And this is another wonderful quote from Eric Erickson that altruism, the best form of altruism is mutuality. It's people growing together. And I think that's what the FAN helps us do as we share with other people. And maybe that's actually the message that we're given when we're working with someone with the FAN framework, is that we are partners together and we're both growing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Well,
thank you. Thanks for asking.
Of course. And thank you for being here, Linda. This was such an honor. And I can't wait to keep learning from you as I always do. So until we meet again, I hope you take very good care.
Thank you. A pleasure to be with you.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a review and share with your friends and coworkers. You can also connect and chat with other listeners through our Facebook group. On behalf of all of us here at the Knowledge Center, thanks for tuning in.